Blog Good evening. Talk Radio.
Good evening. Hi, I'm Paul Smits, your host for this evening, and this is Extreme Ways, The Power of Addiction. Welcome back. Tonight I wanted to do something a little bit different because normally I'm talking about addiction and how to get out of it. But I also wanted people, listeners, to understand who I am as an individual and how I came to do what I'm doing today. Life is a journey, one that molds and shapes us into who we are. Everyone, I believe, serves purpose and everyone is alive with meaning. It took me personally a very long time to understand what my meaning and purpose was, but I had to live life in order to come to that realization. So without further ado, let me jump straight into my story. I'm not using notes on this. I'm just using memory. And because it's a vast story of plus minus 40 years, what I'd like to do is just condense it to the important parts, because I'd like to get to the end result of why it is I'm doing what I'm doing today. So first of all, I was born in Rhodesia, which is now called Zimbabwe, in a city called Salisbury, which is now called Harare. And I was born to a family with two brothers, a sister, a mother and father. And for the most part, had a fairly happy childhood. I was born with a rare blood group, an overabundance of white cells. And so as a baby, I was born blue and I was a little bit fragile. But nonetheless, only 3 years after that did I get very, very sick. And they decided to transfuse me. And so now I have a different blood group altogether, O positive. And why I'm bringing that into perspective is my parents, because of my sickness, sheltered me a little bit. And I remember being taken away, I think it was about the age of four, on a holiday with them where the siblings had to remain behind with their gran. And I believe that was the first time that I was sort of separated from my siblings and sort of grew up a little bit separate to everybody else, because when I came back, things were a little bit different, and I used to spend a lot of time in isolation. So as a kid, I'd run around the mountainside, spending time on my own, entertaining whatever was inside my head. And by the age of eight, we decided to move from Rhodesia to South Africa. And when we moved to South Africa, I'd started school in Rhodesia at the age of five, and in South Africa, they started a little bit later than that. So by the time I got to South Africa, they said I was too young for the group that I needed to go into. And so they kept me back a year. And I also believe that that sort of diminished my school life, because I was very resentful about that. And so didn't pay a lot of attention at school. Spent a lot of time, again, in isolation and messing around. I was the class clown, and I enjoyed that role. And for the most part, as a youngster, it worked. Later on in life, not so much, because I got picked on and bullied by some of the bigger boys, and would sort of retract myself at recess and spend isolated time in the hall. Otherwise, I did very well with the girls. They loved being around me, so I spent a lot of break times with the girls and was ostracized for that as well. So I had a pretty difficult school career, and I really didn't pay attention at all. Nonetheless, come the age of 13, I picked up cigarettes, and I started smoking cigarettes. I would go down to the beach and puff away, copping my lungs out, until eventually I became used to it. And I remember the one day not having any cigarettes, but knowing that the neighbor's son's brother smoked, and he was in the garage fixing his bike. And so I went down and I coyly asked him for a cigarette, and he gave me a cigarette. And I sat with him while he was fixing his motorbike, and we got to talking. Him and I became really good friends. Now, he at that stage was 20 years old, and I was 13 going on 14. And we just connected, and I enjoyed everything that he'd say. I was fascinated with him. He came from the UK. I think they came from a Scottish background, and they were just fascinating as family, and I enjoyed spending time with them. Plus, I got to go around with them on the motorbike, and we became best of buddies, until one day he introduced me to marijuana. And of course, Had my first smoke with them on the beach in silence, away from everybody. Got really out of it and enjoyed the experience very much. So much so that it wasn't long before I was looking for that stuff on my own and starting to include that in my daily routine. Myself and this man ran around. We used to go off to the local city, which was Durban, which was about half an hour from where I lived. I lived on the south coast of Africa at that time. And we would spend our evening smoking, going into hotels, drinking, just spending time running around like loose cannons, with no purpose whatsoever. And I enjoyed smoking so much that it just became a part of my daily life, so much so that eventually I wanted to acquire it on my own. And I would take it home with me and I'd find a space and time to smoke and just lie in my bedroom listening to music. And for the most part, it was very innocent. It was just enjoying a substance that made me feel better than I felt before. And one of the evenings, we decided to go off to Durban, and we were looking for somewhere to go, and we had been asking people where there were nightclubs, and we were pointed out to this one nightclub, and we went along to this place, and as I was walking up the stairs, I heard this music that I had not been familiar with. Now, my brother and my mom spent a lot of time collecting music. We had all the classics from the early 50s right the way up to the modern stuff, which was then in the 80s. You know, I hadn't come across this one particular song that really triggered a whole new world for me. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to play the song because it put everything into context. And the words meant a lot to me, and it was a defining moment in my life.
All I want is nighttime.
Heaven 17, Let Me Go. That was the song that redefined who I was as an individual at that stage of my life. And it truly was. Because played loud, the extended version, which is more instrumental, it had a huge impact on me. And the nightclub that we went to was an alternative nightclub. And so everybody that I saw looked different to what I'd ever seen before. Everyone at that stage was dressed in a new age way. Gothic hadn't come in yet. So it wasn't so much black, it was more alternative, new age thinkers. And I felt right at home. My friend, not so much. So what actually happened was, after experiencing that nightclub, after enjoying it, I made it a mission to make sure that I was there each and every week, Friday and Saturday. That became my playground. And he was not so into it, so I went off on my own. And I would travel on a train late at night and end up in Durban late at night, walk around the city, walk to the beachfront, have a couple of joints, walk back to the nightclub, be the first one there, being there until the doors closed at like between 4 and 6 a.m. and get back on the train and go home, sleep for the day, repeat it. And that became my life for a while. And it was invigorating because it was just so stimulating for me and I enjoyed it. So even though I didn't know people, I felt right at home. And as people got to know me at the club and as I started enhancing how I dressed, because obviously I wanted to fit in, there was a story in between this going back and forth to the club, which I must put in because it was another redefining moment. But whilst at school, there was, you know, we would take our bus trip from a place I lived in, Umkomaas, to Skopje, which is 12 kilometers. And I would sit right in the front of the bus, actually facing inwards to all the seats that were facing towards the driver. I don't know why I did that, but I preferred being in that position. So I always used to sit next to the driver and sort of stare at everybody. And there was this one girl, I really liked her. And I used to stare at her, and actually so much so that it was uncomfortable for her. And the one day she said, you really got to stop doing this. And I said, well, you know, I wouldn't mind getting to know you. And we spent a bit of time becoming friends, not great friends, but becoming friends. And after one of these stints to the nightclub on the weekend, I got back and my father came and said that she was killed crossing the railway tracks, and that maybe I should go and see her mom and just give my condolences. So I went to go and see the mom, and she was distraught, as any mother would be. And I spent time sitting with her, and I said I'd come back and visit her, which I did. We became friends, and she became interested in my life. And my mom and dad were both alcoholics, and they would spend all their evenings in bars, hotels, on the bowling green, at the bowling club. So I wouldn't see them until 11 o'clock at night, and they would come straight back into the room, go to sleep. And so I didn't really have a life because my brothers and sisters were all at varsity or colleges. And this lady took an interest. And when she discovered that I was interested in these alternatives and was questioning me about what they were, she decided to make me an outfit. And so she went out and bought all the material, and she made me a Harlequin outfit, which was probably the best outfit I ever wore. It was a strange outfit, something you shouldn't be seen in the streets with. And I used to wear makeup where I would paint triangles underneath my eyes and dress up like a Harlequin. And I remember packing all my stuff that she had made me, and putting all the makeup together and getting onto the train and then proceeding to get into that outfit while I was in the train. The trains were always empty. And I got completely dressed, did these Harlequins painted my face white, and I was like quite a spooky looking character. And I remember the conductor coming over, and he got an absolute fright when he walked past me. He said, "Oh my God, you know, what? Who is this? Well, what is this?" And he was fascinated, and he sat down next to me and he said, "Well, why do you do this?" And I explained to him about the nightclub, and we sat and we had a normal conversation as if I didn't have any makeup on or anything. And he was very accepting of it and said, "Well, I hope you have a good evening. And I'm not too sure that you should be walking around dressed like that, but you know, youth today, go ahead, do your thing." And I went off to the nightclub. And again, why I say it was a redefining moment is because I was sporting that outfit. So obviously what I wanted to do from an ego point of view was show it off at the nightclub, because now here's the new version of me. And it got a really good reaction. I had the DJ from the nightclub come over to me and tell me how fantastic I looked. As I was dancing away and enjoying the evening, high as a kite, this one girl came over to me, and she grabbed me by my shoulders, and she said, "Oh, I just want to tell you how wonderful you look and how beautiful you are, and do you want to come out and have a cigarette with me?" And I said, "Yeah." And went outside and we had a cigarette. She said, "Look, well, why don't we go down to the beachfront and grab a coffee and chat a while?" And we went off to the beachfront. And we sat there and we were speaking. I was telling her my woe story about how my parents are never around, my brothers and sisters aren't around, I'm all alone. And she said, "You know what? I'll look after you. You don't have to worry about a thing. I'll look after you. I just want to go back into the restaurant, stay here, and you come with me. We're going to do some great stuff. Why don't you come with me? I'm going to go to this other city, Johannesburg." And you know what? I was young and mature, and I thought, why not? This sounds brilliant. And so I waited for her to go into the restaurant. She came out with seven guys, and she said, "I got us a lift." And these seven guys and myself and her jumped into a van, and off we drove, heading towards where she lived. God knows where that was, but heading off in that direction. And I was like pretty much out of it. I'd spent the whole evening. It was early a.m. And I was like on the verge of passing out. And I remember falling asleep in there. And then all of a sudden she said to one of the guys in the van, "Don't you dare touch me." And I kind of woke up and I said to the guy, "Hey, listen, we don't want any problems. Just, you know, leave her alone." And they stopped the van and dropped us off on the highway. And she says to me, "No problem. You know, we're about half a kilometer away from where I live. That's fine." And we went through the brush and ended up at her house. And went into this beautiful home. There was nobody there. And we spent some time talking, finished the weed that I had. And then she said, "You know what? I have to go into town. I've got to organize some drugs for myself. And why don't you stay here? Take it easy, go to sleep, and everything will be okay." And she left. And I stayed up for a while, and her brother came home. And he recognized me from the club. And he said to me, "You know, what are you doing here?" And I said, "No, I'm going to go off to Johannesburg with your sister." And he said, "Look, Paul, you know, this is really not a good idea. You don't know what she's like." And I said, no, it's not a problem whatsoever. I can do this." And he said, "No, this is like, you have no idea what you're getting yourself into. I'm telling you now, what you should do right now is pack your bags and go home, because that would be the safest thing for you to do." And I said, "Nah, it's not going to happen. It's, you know, I'm committed to this. I'm happy. I know how to look after myself. Don't worry about a thing." And he said, "Okay." You know, he could see I wasn't going to change my mind. And he said, "Don't say I didn't warn you." Well, chaos started from there. Because the first thing was, I decided eventually, yeah, I'm going to fall asleep. And there's another song. I'll get over with the songs early. But this is another song that's pivotal for me, because it was the start of what I thought was going to be a wonderful life. The start of something new. And so as I was falling asleep, this was the song that was playing. I'm not going to play the whole song because we're going to run out of time, and I know I've still got an extensive story to tell. So what I want to do is carry on with this from where I left off. So I fell asleep to this song, and I woke up feeling fantastic. She rejoined me. There was havoc in the house. She ended up putting a T-square through her mom's head that evening, blood all over the place. Whole family in disarray, brother taking the mother off to the hospital, two other addicts joining us and making our way to Johannesburg. So I'm going to condense this part because I think what will be best is on the Power of Addiction, the community page. What I'll do is I have written the whole story, not of my entire life, but of this specific chapter. And I'll post that, and you can read it step for step of what happened on that whole journey from the age of, say, 15 right the way up to 17. So it was 2 years of my life. And I'm going to skip through a lot of the parts, but give you the basics. So we ended up going off to Johannesburg, and we arrived in Johannesburg after hitchhiking. It's a long trip. It's a good 8 hours by car. So hitchhiking took us an entire day. And we arrived at a drug addict commune, which was full of other addicts. And on the first evening there, whilst I was just getting associated to where I am, the police broke in. They came crashing through the windows and the doors and pretty much arrested everyone. And the one policeman came over to me and he said to me, I don't recognize you. And I said, no, I'm new. I'm from Durban. I just arrived this evening. And he said to me, listen, you should just pack your bags and go home. So that was the second time someone had told me to pack my bags and go home. It wasn't as if I didn't have due warning that things were going to get bad. But being at that age and being bolshy and arrogant, I stuck in there. And that changed my life. It actually changed who I was, because things from there just got worse and worse. The drug addict commune was full of addicts that were spiking, that's injecting themselves. They were into some hardcore stuff. In those days, it was pinks, which was tuna. They were into morphine. Heroin, not so big. It wasn't so big in those days. And it definitely wasn't cocaine, all that type of stuff. But they were into what we call downers. And I dabbled in a lot of that, but didn't enjoy it. So I ended up just enjoying my marijuana, and that was cheap and easy for me to access. And I'd have alcohol with that. And so that's what I did. But the girl that I was with, to make money to support her habits, prostituted herself. And so I would take her to the escort agents in the evening and drop her off and walk back to the drug addict commune and then go back again at around 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock and pick her up and walk her back again. And of course, each time I did this, she would tell me horrendous stories about what was happening. But I had no idea of what sex was. I'd never had it. So I had no full understanding of what she was going through, except that there was some sexual behavior. And I didn't understand what that meant. So I was very innocent. But I spent a lot of time with her. And she would literally just go to the escort agent, sleep, make money, come back, get drugs, and it was that procedure every single day. It was the quest for drugs, it was the quest to go out and enjoy yourself, and that's all there was to life. So much so that, you know, when times were hard and she wasn't getting enough business to support the habit, she would try and sweet talk men into, you know, lending her money. And I remember one time in a late night international type bar, she convinced some people to give us some money, and they said, you know, give us your ID and, you know, when you're ready to pay us, come pick up your ID. And she did. She would do anything for drugs. And she didn't go back and pay them. And the one morning I was sitting with her in the bath. This was about the worst thing I'd ever seen in life. But she was sitting in the bath and I was sitting there and talking to her. Two men walked in. One pointed a gun at me. The other one grabbed her by her hair, dragged her out of the flat, down the stairs, into a car, and disappeared. About 7 hours later, she was dropped off naked in front of the building and completely beaten up. And she just got up next day, same procedure. No problem whatsoever. In my time there in Johannesburg, I saw it must have been no less than about 6 or 7 people die from overdoses. I saw addict behavior at its worst. In other words, addicts stealing other addict stuff even while they were taking it. We broke into houses. We broke into doctor surgeries. We forged prescriptions. We did everything that we could to keep the drugs flowing. And this went on for 2 years of my life. And she eventually hooked up with someone and so-called fell in love. and kind of disappeared off the scene. And I was left walking around the streets in Johannesburg on my own, now without that support structure of having her around, having to fend for myself, which didn't last very long. Because I knew a lot of people and we'd been running around, but you know, addicts aren't that loyal to each other. And so I was pretty much on my own. And I remember the one night I was like almost starving and thinking to myself, you know, I have to do something. I was even contemplating prostituting myself in order to be able to, you know, just get the money I needed for food and the drugs that I wanted. But came to my senses after almost doing it. In other words, chasing a car down because I thought there was a prospect. And I said to myself, yeah, what are you doing, Paul? And so I went back to the dry commune, grabbed my stuff, and hitchhiked all the way home. Took me a day and a half to get home. I eventually got home, knocked on the front door. My dad opened and said, welcome back. This was 2 years later. They didn't ask me another question about what happened. And it was trying to get back into life. I was not the same person that left. I was innocent. I was naive. I was not well versed in how the world operates and what could happen. Coming back, I'd seen so much that it redefined who I was as an individual. And I certainly didn't know where I would fit in, but I did know I'd fit back into the club. But my banner in the works, and because I didn't want to go back to school, they volunteered me for the army. And so I went and spent 2 years in the army. In that 2 years in the army, I caused as much problems as I could. Still stayed on drugs, induced asthma attacks that would make them send me to the hospital the whole time. And when I was in the hospital, in this one military hospital, it's in Pretoria, and it's a magnificent place. It was just the best hospital in Africa at that time. And I remember going into the ward one of the times that I went in, and right next to me in the bed was one of the dealers that used to deal with heroin and morphine and a couple of other things. And I was like so happy to see him, and he started putting morphine into my drip. And so I was getting high in the hospital, I was getting high in the army, until eventually they decided to send me back to Durban. And I could finish my 2 year stint with the army in Durban. But again, didn't behave because put me close to Durban. I was close to the club. I started going to the club all the time and going AWOL from the army until they caught me. And the nightclub owner came and saw me in the psychiatric ward that they put me in. And he said to me, would you be interested in playing at the nightclub? In other words, taking over as a DJ. And I said, absolutely. You know, that was one of the things I wanted to do most, was to run that nightclub. And so he went somehow, spoke to them, and they actually gave me an honorable discharge and said, like, you can have him. We don't want him. And they let me go. I then proceeded to run the nightclub. It was a very short stint, so it was probably about 9 months that I did it for. And again, you know, intoxicated the whole time, on whatever drugs I could get my hands on the whole time. Sometimes didn't finish my sets at night. So it was difficult for me. From there, I decided, you know, I have to make a change in my life. I decided to go back home. Home wasn't there anymore. My mom and dad had split up. The actual flat was empty. And I had to decide what I was going to do. And my father said to me, well, why don't you go with your brother to Pretoria and stay there and contemplate what you're going to do in life? I went with my brother. That didn't work out. We were fighting the whole time. I left there, went back to Johannesburg thinking, okay, well, I knew Johannesburg, I could try and make it work. A man very kindly, when I was selling my radio and saw that I was doing t-shirts, set me up with a practice to print t-shirts. He felt some empathy for me and my story, and actually facilitated a beginning of a working career for myself, which led to other careers creatively. And so I ended up being able to work for a magazine in Johannesburg. And it was ironically enough in the same office as my sister, and worked in the magazine industry for a number of years, and then moved on from that industry to graphic design. And from graphic design, I moved to nationwide merchandising for a toy company, a mega toy company in South Africa. And in that time, I'd gotten married, I'd had my first child, and I was just still using and still miserable. Fighting with my wife the whole time, not making sense, jumping from job to job, not really understanding what life was like. I hadn't grown up yet. And years and years later, after going through years of self-medicating, I eventually became depleted, where nothing was working. Relationship wasn't working. I felt like I was just doing everyone an injustice, and spent most of the time sitting in the garden smoking weed while everyone stayed in the house, and I would do that late at night, and not having any understanding about what life was about. I'd burnt all my bridges and lost most of my jobs, and just really couldn't figure it out. In fact, I was at that stage contemplating suicide because I just had nothing to live for. I couldn't see anything to live for. And so I decided there has to be something different to what I'm seeing and understanding about the world. There has to be. There has to be a reason. There has to be a purpose. I can't just be here for nothing. I'm creative. I can do all sorts of different things. And yet I'm just not making any sense of anything. And we had a second child, a daughter, and when she was about four, this is a quick story I need to put in here, because this is another redefining moment. Had a daughter, and when she was about four, I strolled in from smoking late at night and waking up late, grabbed a cup of coffee, moseyed through to the living room, and she was playing shopkeeper on the dining room table, and she had a whole lot of books laid out, and she said, "Oh, Dad, come, you know, buy a book. I've got a whole lot of books, so it's a bookstore." And I said, okay, what kind of books do you have? And she said, you know, how about this one? And she picked up a book, and it was a book that my wife had shown me before. It was not Neil Donald Walsh, it was Wayne Dyer. The Power of Intention. And I had a bad association with the book, but I played along. I said, okay, that looks like a good book. And I said to her, how much is it? And she said, 50 cents. And so I rummaged in my pockets. I found 50 cents, gave it to her. She put it in the packet for me. And as she gave me the packet, she grabbed me on both cheeks. And she looked at me deep in the eyes. And she said, this is very important. And I couldn't work out. I had a little chill in my spine because I couldn't figure out why she was saying that. But I took the book outside and I was curious, and I thought, okay, you know, 50 cents, here's this book, let me go to page 50. I kind of thought that way. And at the top of the page, there was these words, be love. And underneath it was a paragraph, and I read the paragraph, and I did not understand a word of what they were saying. It made no sense to me whatsoever. It was definitely not an idea of what love was to me. And so I questioned this. And as I started beginning to question all of this, I started receiving different information about how this world works. I started seeing the world from a different point of view. And it was not because of the book. It was because I was starting to look at things a little bit differently and starting to explore other things. And this is where I decided to put down the drugs. And for me, that was a hard process. It was subject to a lot of relapses. But over time and going to NA and spending time reading as much material as I could and looking at this new concept of the law of attraction and the power of intention and that type of thing, I started exploring a different avenue. And I remember being very, very frustrated and not being able to work out how do I apply all this stuff into my life that I'm learning. And I remember being very upset and saying to God, please, if you can just give me the manual as to how to live life, I promise you I'll teach everyone. And lo and behold, about 4 months later, I was given a set of audio discs, which was the Abraham Hicks discs. And it changed how I saw things because I spent a lot of time. That was about, 10 hours worth of audio. And I re-listened to them, and then had a look at life because I was a huge skeptic. So I wanted to sort of look at everything and try and figure out, what is truth with regards to this universal truth. And as I did that, I started seeing things very differently from a different perspective. And I started seeing that there were some universal truths. There were some things that made sense to me that sort of added up the pieces. But for me, it wasn't the full story. It was just a part of a story that I was very attracted to. And so what I decided to do was what I wanted most was if this information could come through, and I could get access to it by just asking, because this is what the information tells you. You ask and you receive. Then certainly I should receive it. And I had a huge desire for this. And so I began asking to receive information. And after I eventually separated from my wife and separated myself into a flat and I was clean, I started asking about different topics in the world. And lo and behold, this information started flooding into my mind. It was not an audio voice, it was just my own type of voice in my head, but it was a stream of thoughts. And I started writing the stream of thoughts down. And I eventually decided, I need to type these out. So as I was having these streams of thoughts, I was typing out the information. And I was rereading the information afterwards and saying to myself, oh, wow, that's profound. That's a very different way of looking at things. And so I started learning from what I believe was the universe and that we do have this ability to access information. And as I started accessing the information, I started learning from it. As I started learning from it, I started asking bigger questions. And as I asked bigger questions, I started writing more. And so that's how I came to write the information that I'm writing today. It was a 9-year journey to the stuff that I'm writing today. But it certainly started then. And it started in a very profound way. It kind of covered all the negative emotions first, then all the positive emotions, and then aspects about health and the world that we live in, then observational skills. And I just was so hungry for information that I would just go into my head every single day. And I would just literally write this information as it came out. And so I don't want to claim magic or channeling or anything like that. All I want to do is say it was a very natural process. And for me, it was an enjoyable process. It was something that was stimulating and it was something that I was netting from. Because as I learned from that information, I started making changes. And here's the big thing. When I started asking the question about what's my meaning and purpose, I'd made a deal with God and said, if you give me the information, I'll give it away. In other words, I'll teach people. But more so, what aspect do I want to teach? Besides law of attraction, there was addiction. I'd seen the suffering in the field of addiction to an extent that most people don't see. It was kind of like if anyone's seen Trainspotting, it's a bit like that. It's extreme ways. And I wanted to be able to help those people in the darkness because I saw so many that go into this field and die. And so I decided to really dedicate myself to that end, printed out flyers, put them around communities, started offering my services to people and where I can, helping people. And over the years, guided my way to becoming a counselor, where I could counsel people and actually understand how to best help people. It took me years to be able to get to that position, because it's not through trial and error, it's through doing it the right way. And so each time that you do it, you learn a little bit more about how better to do it. And I'm devoted to this end. So when I do handle cases, I handle them very thoroughly and try and make sure that people come out the other side a better, new, improved version of themselves, clean and ready to embrace life. Because I knew so many people, even though they were in recovery, were not able to embrace life. They were kind of stuck in recovery. And I wanted more for people. And so that's why today I'm being the person that I am. I put myself out here to be able to take the wisdom that I've learned over the years and take the information that God's granted me and be able to use it in a wise way to enable people in a realistic way to make shifts in their lives. And so I've kind of narrowed it down to two practices. I do addiction on the one side, which I can't take too many cases at once because it's quite a difficult field to manage. And at the same time, write still on the law of attraction, universal law, self-help material, and do life coaching. And it's rewarding because as I do it for people, I notice significant changes in people's lives. And that for me has given me meaning and purpose. That's what I wake up for every single day. It's what I want to improve and do more and more as time goes by. So I'm going to put one more song in. I'm getting a bit tongue-tied right now, and then we'll close off today's episode. That was Dada, and This Is The Day. And what I want to say most, just in ending off this episode, is that your life can change. You can find meaning and purpose. And let me tell you that what you go through in life is not for nothing. There's a good reason why you go through the experiences that you go through, no matter how traumatic they may seem. It adds up to wisdom. And when it adds up to wisdom, you're able to convert that into something so powerful to be able to help and uplift others. So just remember, everyone, what I'm going to do is I'm going to post part of that story on The Power of Addiction, the community page on Facebook. And for those of you who are active addiction or in recovery or past recovery, keep joining us here on the show. Next week, we're going to have a very informative show about building your life. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm your host, Paul Smith, and I look forward to speaking to you again. Bye for now.
Time to get wise.